said. At the break, I casually approached my acting partner, who was smoking a cigarette. She exhaled a long plume of smoke, and I worked up the courage to say, "That went really well."
"It got off to a rough start," she replied.
"Yeah, sorry, but after that, I thought it went pretty great," I said, hoping I struck the right chord. "We rebounded."
"I guess we did," she gave me a little smile.
Clearly, we were simpatico, a potential match if ever there was one. Her kiss was all the clarity I needed. I went for the close. "We should have lunch sometime." She looked confused, and then she looked at me as if I were a lost puppy. "Oh," she said without affect, "no." Seeing that I was still in the dark, she added, "I have a boyfriend."
"What?
But you just kissed me as if I were the most desirable man on earth. You grinded your pelvis into mine and moaned as if you couldn't get enough of me." That's what I thought of saying. Instead, I feigned indifference.
"Hey, that's cool, you know, whatever."
Indifference was my go-to whenever I felt vulnerable. I was not mature enough to be honest and show surprise, even though that was my feeling. Utter shock. I felt like I was the victim of a practical joke. Her lips pursed again. This time it was more sorry than sexy. She might as well have patted me on the head and told me I reminded her of her little brother. But I remained inscrutable. No sign of surprise or disappointment or confusion. She gave me a consoling smile and walked away. She wasn't into me. I mean, not at all. She was acting. She was given the task of pretending to be hot for me, and that is what she did. I had to sit down. What had just happened? It had been a kiss. Just a kiss. A month later, I wouldn't remember her name. But she left me with something I'd never forget. I'd learned that you could so fully inhabit a character that you could fool others, move others. With talent and commitment, you could seduce or terrify. You could make someone feel utter hate, or desolation, or compassion, or even love. Biker. Ed passed his entrance exams easily. The next step was to start the training academy and pick up his gun and badge at the Orange County Sheriff's Department. At 22, he was fully legal. He was a man. And yet he wasn't sure what he wanted in life. When he got the call from the sheriff's department to confirm his acceptance, he hesitated. I was also tentative about what to do next. My junior college experience gave me one orderly year of studying police science and 1 year of emotional chaos in acting classes. I had enough credits to transfer to university, but now I wasn't sure what my field should be. If I stayed the course and chose a path that aligned with my aptitude, was I embarking on a life of compromise and regret? If I threw it all away and jumped into acting, was I being impulsive, foolish? I had seen what became of actors like my father. That all-or-nothing approach to stardom exacted a heavy toll. I knew an actor's life would be hard. It could even be tragic. My father's failure as an actor had contributed to the implosion of my family. He wanted success more than anything, and it eluded him. Maybe because he wanted it so desperately. I didn't know why he had left. I wondered about it, but I didn't know for sure. I had ideas, ego and alcohol were factors, but trying to boil it down to one reason was a loser's game. He left. That was all. He pursued a life without us. I was mature enough to accept that ours was not a unique condition, but I think that's part of what left me struggling in those years. Grasping and sneaky-peeting, I was still lost. And I really didn't have anyone other than Ed to talk about how I felt or about what I should do with my life. Who knows where my dad was? And by that time, my mom was drinking steadily. She was there, but not really there at all. By now, she was remarried to a drinking buddy named Peter, and they moved to Fresno, dragging Amy with them. In subsequent years, they pinged over to Massachusetts and then down to Florida, where they bought a motel. It didn't work out in the end. Terrible idea, really.
No matter her physical location, my mom was flirty and coquettish, sashaying around the house singing Peggy Lee's anthem of loneliness, "Is That All There Is?" I had my brother, and we were on our own, and we were at a crossroads. We had talked about doing a big trip for a while. Why not now? Why lock into a job in the sheriff's department when we could see the country? We could be free. Would there be a better time to go? It was 1976, the bicentennial. The pageantry was extensive. Fireworks and Spirit of 76 public service announcements made by men in Founding Father costumes and tall-masted ships in the nation's large harbors. Small towns painted their fire hydrants red, white, and blue. The Vietnam War was behind us at last. It had been 3 years since Nixon had tried to make our country's loss more palatable with his Peace with Honor speech. They stopped the draft the year before my brother came of age. He had to register, and his number was low, in the single digits. Had he been 1 year older, he would have gone. Jimmy Carter would soon be president-elect, and despite the occasional gas shortages and high inflation, the country was starting to feel less fraught with strife than it had felt during the war. With the Steppenwolf road anthem, Born to be Wild, playing in our heads, we left California on motorcycles for parts unknown, duration unknown. Everything was unknown. My Honda 550cc was loaded, my saddlebags and scoot boot filled with the essentials, a sleeping bag and a pup tent, a mess kit and a camp stove, a change of clothes and all-weather gear. I had a full tank of gas and $175 in my pocket. Ed's bike had a bumper sticker on its rear end that read, "I'm hot to trot." It only took a few days to get the hang of life on the road. Ed and I developed hand signals to indicate our current needs. Gas, food, sleep, mechanical issue, whatever, we had a signal for it. Since we had no money to spare, we were sleeping under the stars every night. In the country, we'd find a cozy patch of grass and bed down. But most cities prohibited sleeping on open land, public or private. So on weekdays, we'd seek peaceful sleep at churches, synagogues, and temples. If we happened to hit a town during a weekend when houses of worship were otherwise occupied, our search shifted to schools. One evening in Yuma, Arizona, we were in a middle school playing field, lounging in our sleeping bags and heating up some Ovaltine on our mini burner as a nightcap. Born to be wild. All of a sudden, 4 or 5 police cars burst into view. Having the background in police procedure, we were out of our sleeping bags with our arms stretched out wide before they had gotten out of their cars. They surrounded us, guns drawn, barking orders. Ed and I glanced at each other. We calmly complied and lay prone on the ground, model suspects. With one knee in our backs, officers patted us down while others carefully searched our bikes and belongings. One officer sifted through our powdered beverage hoping to find narcotics. To his dismay, he found only Ovaltine. We were clean. On the road, we couldn't make plans because everything was always changing. Everything, where we were, how we felt, what we thought, the weather. Riding in a car, you're a passenger. You're shielded by glass and metal, protected from the elements. On a motorcycle, you feel it all, moment by moment, the soft breeze at dawn, the warmth of the early light, the bugs, the heat, the dust, the thick smell of desert blooms, and the scent of dirt after a rain. The road beneath you. You're open to the elements. You have to be present so you can react and adapt to whatever you encounter. That felt like freedom. When we were broke and severe weather made it dangerous or just plain uncomfortable to be outside, we stayed a few times at homeless shelters. One night, as a storm threatened, we sought refuge at the Star of Hope Mission in Houston, Texas. We locked our bikes together to a post and covered them as best we could, hoping the storm wouldn't drown them. Inside the shelter, we learned that the protocol was to bolt the doors for the night and require all of us homeless men, temporary or otherwise, to listen to some proselytizing. Normally, I was open to those moved to speak about their faith, but the guy at this shelter was a fear-mongering zealot, delivering the news about how God would damn to hell anyone who drank or did drugs. I found his threats offensive and laughable. It was ridiculous, that people had to be subjected to this kind of fire and brimstone speechifying simply because they needed a place to sleep for the night. After the dark sermon, we were led upstairs in single file, and we were asked to strip naked and turn in our clothes for the night. We handed our garments to an attendant, who gave us each a numbered tag to claim them in the morning. The attendant put the clothes of about 100 transient men into a walk-in closet and bolted the door shut. Great. I'll probably never see those pants again. Next was a parade to the showers. Every man was given a bar of soap, more aptly a tab, and a hand towel intended to serve as a bath towel. We took turns pulling the chain on a half a dozen shower heads. The tepid water drizzled over us, washing our bodies clean of sins, or at least some road grime. Dropping off the towelettes and a drum on our exit, and the excess slivers of soap in a bucket, we were shown to the hall where 50-some-odd bunk beds were arranged in tight rows. It looked like an internment camp. We were assigned our bunks. Younger, able-bodied men on top, older and infirm men got the preferred bottom. 100 men sleeping in the same room. 100 men who happened to have the worst eating and drinking habits in the country. A cacophony of belching and farting. The smell of gas, stale alcohol, fumes from festering wounds left untreated, and years of poor hygiene that no shower could ameliorate. Most were hardcore smokers, with deep hacking coughs to prove it. Decay permeated the room. I thought back to my morgue experience. Which was worse, the smell of formaldehyde? Or this. I was hard-pressed to say. I looked over several rows of bunks to my brother. A lucky bastard got a bunk by a window, which he had cracked open just enough for the cool breeze to lull him to sleep. I tried to sleep with the covers over my head. Good luck. I prayed for dawn to show itself, and when the first signs of light came through Ed's window, I jumped out of bed first in line to get my clothes and get the hell out of there. The attendant from the night before sleepily took my chit and opened the vault. He handed me my clothes, and oh, God. While I'd awaited the morning, my relatively clean clothes had been wrestling with everyone else's filthy duds in a sealed enclosure. I had no choice but to put these deliriously toxic things on. I was desperate to get outside to my motorcycle, but not so fast. First, breakfast. In our putrid state, we were marched into the mess hall and seated on long communal benches, a tin plate and cup set before each man. We were served a plop of porridge, a package of Melba toast, and coffee. I tasted a speck of porridge. Looked like spackle. Tasted like spackle. The coffee, too, matched my expectations. It was the hue of scorched butter. The taste reminded me of my childhood habit of putting coins in my mouth. That slightly bitter, metallic flavor with an aftertaste of rust. I looked several feet down the bench to Ed, who was grinning. He had been watching me from spackle to rust. His grin made me smile, too. Then I looked across the table and saw a dour face staring back. The fellow leaned forward and whispered, as if we were in a prison movie planning our escape and couldn't risk drawing the attention of the guards, "Hey, ain't you gonna eat that?" "No," I whispered back. "You can have it." I slid my food over to him. His toothless grin said thank you. When we escaped the clutches of the Star of Hope, Ed and I went straight to a laundromat to wash the stench from our clothes. I wasn't sure they could ever be clean again. In spite of our stench, we felt freer than ever after our night in captivity, and more exhausted. Before sunset that night, we pooled our meager funds and got a cheap motel somewhere in East Texas, and I collapsed instantly, feeling dead. After that, we agreed, no more shelters. From then on, we slept at schools, churches, parks, golf courses, and historical sites. Late one night, we found a park that seemed remote, tossed our sleeping bags over the fence, and bedded on the grass, faces up to the open sky above. In the morning, I awoke to a plop. It was dawn, and I didn't see anyone around, so I lay my head back down. Plop! There was another one. I turned my head and saw an egg rolling downhill toward me. A bird? When it rolled to a stop, I saw that it wasn't an egg. It was a golf ball. In the cover of darkness, we had bedded down on a fairway. We grabbed our sleeping bags and waved to the puzzled golfers as we scaled the fence. We arrived in Little Rock, Arkansas after dark on a weeknight and set ourselves up on a perfect patch of grass by the back door of a church. We'd be up and out by sunrise before anyone was awake. In the middle of the night, a car woke us up as it drove onto the loose gravel driveway. Its front tire stopped within an arm's reach of us. In the darkness, I could see Ed's fear. I lay frozen, too. The door creaked open. We saw two black shoes crushing the gravel beneath them. Another man got out of the passenger side and followed the driver into the church. They were murmuring to each other, trying to be stealthy. They didn't want to get caught. We couldn't make out a word. Were they there to rob the church? I glanced at Ed. He reached for the all-purpose knife he was carrying, the only weapon we had. It was possible they didn't see us. We were in dark sleeping bags in the shadows, and we had parked our bikes elsewhere. We waited in silence. The church's back doors flung open, and we saw one man walking backward. Then we saw that he was pulling something on a flat dolly. A desk? A couch? No, it was a casket. We remained silent, terrified. The men opened the back hatch of the sedan and slid the casket in. Suddenly they were pulling away. The gravel crackled and popped beneath their tires like gunfire. Would they come back for us? Should we run? Remain still? Did they need more bodies? We were half asleep and barely sane. We finally calmed down enough to devise a plan. We wouldn't leave, but we'd stay awake, on guard. We'd remain alert. We woke at dawn. So much for alert. We looked around and realized that, given our fatigue and the darkness, we failed to notice we'd camped behind a mortuary. We hurried to wrap our sleeping bags, and a few people came out the back door and asked us to come inside for some coffee and donuts. We joined them in the kitchen, and they told us they had seen us the night before. We sat in the car for a minute trying to figure out how to make our delivery without waking you guys last night. We whispered so we wouldn't disturb you. When we were beyond road-weary, we'd spring for a dirt-cheap motel. Once in rural Louisiana, or maybe it was Mississippi, it was pouring, so we drove our bikes right into the room with us. The next day, we backed them out. Amazingly, we didn't draw the ire of the manager. For that matter, our filthy bikes didn't much affect the general cleanliness of the room. A real five-star situation. We had no problem finding temporary jobs as we traveled. We'd bus tables at a diner for cash, or we'd get jobs at the venue ever in need of sober workers, a carnival. When we were living with our grandparents and killing chickens, Ed and I briefly had after-school jobs at a carnival about a mile from us. We worked a game of chance joint, the carny name for booth. I held a fistful of darts and exhorted passers-by, "Hey, come on over, take a chance." One time I even accidentally punctured my own hand with a dart when a girl I knew from school came over to say hello. Real cool. So we sort of knew our way around a carnival, and we got a job during what was called slaw. I don't know why exactly, maybe from the word slaughter. It was how the carnies described closing down the carnival at that location. We dismantled the whole place top to bottom and stacked it on trucks. The tilt-a-whirl, the wild mouse, the Ferris wheel, and all the joints had to come down. It was hard work, but decent pay. I think we got $8 per hour, cash. Enough to get us wherever the road took us next. Suspect. We arrived in Daytona Beach just in time for a Thanksgiving feast with our maternal cousins, the Tafts. They lived in a big house at 715 North Halifax Avenue. The intercoastal waterway was basically their backyard. Of the seven Taft kids, Ed and I felt the most kinship with Frederick, Freddie, a handsome, skinny, blonde, girl-crazed, fun-loving knucklehead and local man about town. He convinced Ed and me to sing at a local nightclub for fun. We actually won a few first-place prizes. Mine came from singing Elvis tunes. Freddie pushed me out of my shell. Before him, I don't think you'd have seen me on stage singing Heartbreak Hotel. Our cousins were gracious hosts, but Ed and I didn't want to overstay our welcome, so we found a cheap place not too far away from them on Oleander Avenue, conveniently located next to a 7-Eleven. During the day, we picked up odd jobs. We worked at a co-op natural food store, dividing up bulk foods like honey, peanut butter, and oats to be sold. We didn't get paid, but we got food at cost. And we got jobs at the local minor league stadium for the Montreal Expos spring training, selling programs and hats and pictures and stuff that people didn't want. On hot days, Ed and I would get at the top of the stairs and yell, "Ice, cold, hats!" We had a staged routine, and we'd have the ball players turning around and watching us in the stands. At night, we easily found jobs as waiters at the Hawaiian Inn Polynesian restaurant and showroom. It was there we met Peter Wong, a man we would come to hate. A little man in every sense, in stature and in spirit, he was incongruously loud. His screaming went on without end. Peter was the Hawaiian Inn chef, and if an order came out wrong from the kitchen, he'd go crazy on the servers, even if the error was the kitchen's fault. Loud enough for the whole restaurant to hear, he would bitch and scream about your complete worthlessness and stupidity. He was a culinary dictator, ruling his kitchen with an iron walk. Except with women. Around women, he blushed like a schoolboy. The male waiters came to an understanding with their female shift partners each night. "I'll do any other dirty work so long as you deal with Peter." Imagining all the different ways we might murder Peter Wong became a group pastime. Personally, I thought it would be fitting to create a new dish in his honor, made with savory spices, fresh vegetables, and slow-cooked, thinly sliced chef. I'd call it Mugu Gai Peter. Other than Peter, life at the Hawaiian Inn was good, profitable, and spicy. It was the 1970s, pre-AIDS. If you caught something, you could easily get penicillin. So the consequences of sexual liberty seemed minimal. Practically everyone you met had had crabs at some point. It was almost a badge of pride. Wild parties and drunken sexual encounters were common. We spent many nights gathered in a large booth at the ABC bar just down the street from the inn. We played liar's poker and drank and were cavalier with our tip money. Still, Ed and I saved most of the money we made and planned to soon get back on the road. When the season was over, the restaurant scaled back to fewer hours and fewer workers, and we took off. Once we were gone, something happened. Peter Wong, the chef that everyone wanted to kill? Someone did. Just days after Ed and I left for our trip up the East Coast, Peter disappeared, vanished. He had been gone for a week when the police came in to talk to the few remaining waitstaff. Did anyone know where Peter might have gone? Check the dog track or Hailai Pavilion, everyone said. He was an inveterate gambler. No one socialized with that creep. The cops pressed on. Did anyone ever mention a desire to harm or kill Mr. Wong? Everyone went silent. Finally, a waiter raised his hand and said, "Yes." The cops asked, "Who?" "Everyone." Our co-workers at the restaurant regaled the officers with tales of the man's repugnant personality in vivid detail. We all thought about how we'd kill him. Why were they asking? "Because," the detective said, "he was found dead, murdered." Silence. Then came the second bombshell question. "Is there anyone no longer employed here who also talked about killing Mr. Wong?" Some of the group exchanged looks. "Yeah, the Cranston brothers. They took off on their motorcycles last week." "That's right around the estimated time of death of Mr. Wong," one officer said. The officer took descriptions of our persons, our bikes, our approximate destination. Everyone cooperated. Our cousin Freddie later told us that the authorities put an all-points bulletin out on us, but then canceled it 2 days later when they found out what had really happened. Peter always carried a thick wad of cash. Apparently he was flashing it at the dog track, and he showed it to the wrong hooker. She lured him to a house where he was jumped and killed. His body was found in the trunk of an abandoned car, bludgeoned to death, cashless. A gruesome way to die, and I felt awful. that I didn't feel awful. Vagabond. We made plans to rendezvous with the girls. We even pinpointed and triangulated the locations of our recent paramours on a map for maximum efficiency. The little dots represented free places to stay, eat, and rekindle relations. We called it the Gidget, the geographically incredibly desirable girlfriend tour. We rode through Georgia and the Carolinas up to the northeastern states headed for Maine. We were happy to be traveling again, happy to be unmoored from the encumbrances and worries of workaday life. Being on the road simplified things in some ways, but complicated them in others. There's no complacency on the road. We always had to be aware. We became experts at recognizing potentially dangerous situations. Still, for every danger, there was a delight. Every face you see is a new one. Adventure and surprise are right around the next corner. Around the Carolinas, we encountered a group of bikers at a truck stop diner. They were doing the same kind of aimless, indefinitely long trip as we were. They were just a lot dirtier. Their hogs rattled and spewed choking exhaust out of the tailpipes they had modified to ensure maximum decibels as they twisted their throttles. We rode dependable Hondas that comparatively made no sound. They sat back in their seats while we sat upright. They had 8 bars reaching for the sky to hold on. We had our arms at a comfortable horizontal level. We rode with the comfort of a windscreen. They had to pick bugs out of their teeth. We did coke and Sanka while they did pot and cocaine. So when their leader came over to inspect our bikes, we were a little nervous. We could tell right away he was a ballbuster, and his look was so on the nose that if you were to cast him in a movie, people would say, too cliche. Torn leather pants, thick leather belt with a skull buckle, leather vest and jacket, leather bracelets and necklaces. The man liked his leather. He had the hair of a rock and roll wannabe. He reeked of the road and snickered at our bikes and packs. Snickering was acceptable, much better than a fist to the throat. He gained instant, albeit measured, respect for us when he noticed our California plates.
Whoa. You ride all the way from Cali?
Yep, we said proudly. He nodded his approval. The interview portion of the introduction was going surprisingly well. Then our rough-and-tumble friend asked,
"You got bitches?"
A pause. Had I heard him wrong? "What's that?" I said. He repeated,
"You got bitches?"
Aha! I did not hear him wrong. He just asked if we had bitches. My uneasiness made me get risky with my new friend. Well, my brother and I argued about this. I thought he was responsible for bringing the bitches, but he insists it was my mistake, so here we are, on the road, with no bitches. He stared at me blankly, no inkling that I was fucking with him. It was a stupid move on my part. He took his time and assessed our situation. Just stared. Did I screw up? Were he and his posse about to beat us to a pulp? He got real serious and hyper-focused, despite his obvious inebriation, in order to bestow upon us a valuable life lesson. He said,
"You gotta get yourself some bitches. My bitch is in there right now."
He pointed to the truck stop diner.
"She's making cash, giving head to truckers, while I just had me some steak and eggs. Steak and eggs."
She sounded like a keeper. I turned to Ed and he said, "We gotta get us some bitches." "Right away," I replied, "like in the next town." We thanked our motorcycle Zen master, hopped on our bikes, and left quickly. We were on the road, living wild, for us. But compared to other anarchic road warriors, we were squares, and always would be. Our Gidget was going according to plan. We were making our way up the eastern seaboard, but as per our habit, we were running behind schedule. Our aim was to make it out of New England by late summer. The fall in New England is beautiful, if you're by a fireside sipping apple cider. Not so great on a motorcycle. We didn't make it to New York until October. A lot of important things happened in 1977. Apple Computers became a company. Elvis gave his last concert and took his last breaths. The Son of Sam murders were solved. My brother and I were in New York for another historic event. My Los Angeles Dodgers were taking on the perennial powerhouse New York Yankees. The 1977 Bronx's Burning World Series. And we were there. Ed and I had to go. But of course we had no tickets and we were running low on money. So we figured we had to sneak in to Yankee Stadium during a World Series. All balls, no brains. The greatest thing about youth is that you are not yet battle-weary, so you'll try anything. We locked up our bikes near the YMCA in Midtown where we were staying and hopped on the subway to the Bronx. We arrived at Yankee Stadium. You can have something described to you 1,000 times and still be unprepared for what it's like in life. Pre-skyboxes, pre-corporate sponsorship, Yankee Stadium was a giant, roiling energy machine, full of loudmouths and troublemakers and dyed-in-the-wool fans. It was a monolith, and you could feel its history, its majesty. We were in awe. We had to find a way in. We sniffed around to assess our options. The place was crawling with scalpers. Not a real option for us since their tickets were much higher than face value. We couldn't see any way to climb a fence or steal into a service entrance. Security and police were everywhere. We were just about to sulk back to the subway when some guy with cartoonish buck teeth whispered,
"Yous wanna get into the game?"
We had him repeat the sentence just to hear his lyrically thick accent. "Sure," we said, "but how much?"
"My cousin's the ticket taker at Gate 3," he said. "You each put a 20 under these old tickets and you're in."
He handed us a couple of used tickets. Ed and I looked at each other. "Are we doing this?" We nodded to each other and lined up at the cousin's gate. We saw cops on the other side of the turnstiles watching happy ticket holders enter the stadium. Our hearts pounding. We slipped the bogus tickets to the cousin with our 20s folded underneath. When he felt the bills in his hand, he just said,
"All right, enjoy the game."
And just like that, we were in. We found two seats behind the Dodger dugout along the third baseline. Heaven. A few outs into the game, an usher reminded us that we didn't actually have seats. We resigned ourselves to pinging around the stadium, getting kicked out of seat after seat for the rest of the game. We zeroed in on two empty seats about 10 rows behind the Yankee dugout. We made our way there, pausing to check our fake tickets to give our neighbors the impression that we were in the right place, before slipping into our temporary seats. The first half inning was just ending. We wondered how long it would be before another usher would give us the bum's rush. It never happened. We watched the entire game from those fantastic seats. What luck. Well, with two exceptions. The Dodgers lost that game. They'd go on to lose the series. And at one point, a New Yorker right behind us, a diehard Yankee fan, didn't approve of us rooting so enthusiastically for our team. He gently reasoned with us by brandishing a knife and threatening us through gritted teeth,
"Sit the fuck down and shut the fuck up, or I'll stab yous in the fucking backs."
For the rest of the game, we became Yankee fans. Winter was closing in, so we scuttled plans to go farther north and headed back to Florida. We decided to ride south on the Blue Ridge Parkway, which runs from Virginia through to North Carolina along the crest of the Smoky Mountains. The ride is beautiful on a motorcycle. Unless it's rainy, foggy, and cold. Then it's a pain in the ass. That's how Ed and I found it. Stuck on a serpentine, slippery road without the payoff of a nice view. Miserable. The rain was pelting so hard, it's a miracle we saw the picnic area 1 mile ahead sign. We hand-signaled to each other. We needed to find shelter. We turned off the parkway and glided down the road to a small clearing near a running creek. The picnic area was basic. 4 corner posts and a modest roof sheltered a table. We drove our bikes inside the shelter, rearranged the table to accommodate the bikes and pup tents, our fancy digs for the night. We opened up one of our carburetor valves with a screwdriver to trickle out fuel for our camp stove, and we heated up some water to dissolve 2 chicken bouillon cubes for supper. We shared a couple Rye Krisp crackers, and then after dinner there was gin, as in gin rummy. Ed and I got so good at knowing each other's strategy that the games would go on for hours. Thank God, because the rainfall was relentless. All we had was time. Eventually, we brushed our teeth and scrubbed our faces of road grime and retired to our tents. Tomorrow, we would continue our sojourn south. I climbed into my sleeping bag and cracked open my one literary companion on the trip, a thick anthology of plays I had included when we packed up our Hondas back in California. I had so loved my acting classes in junior college that I thought if I was going to entertain being an actor, I'd better start reading. I'd better start learning. I had just finished Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, which I loved. I was just starting Henrik Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. I got a few pages in before I felt the pull of sleep. The next morning was like the day before. Rain. Looked like we would have to spend another night. On the plus side, we wouldn't run out of drinking water, the main ingredient in top ramen, Sanka, Postum, a powdered malt beverage, instant hot chocolate, and of course, bouillon soup. Add to that a baggie of raisins and peanut mix, and Rye Krisp crackers, or the saltines we'd stuffed our pockets with at roadside cafes, and we had a veritable feast. Day 3. More rain. Steady rain. No sign of any other soul. We thought about leaving and finding the next town to check into a motel, but realized that we could be 10 or 100 miles away. No GPS in those days. We didn't know exactly where on this beautiful goddamn Blue Ridge Parkway we had landed. We'd have to wait it out. Our routine continued. Meager meals followed by some calisthenics to keep us loose, conversation to keep us sane, gin to keep us interested, and reading to pass the time. Day 4, the same. Day 5, the same. I stared out at the rain, mesmerized by its constancy, the utter lack of change. I grew up in eternally blue-skied Southern California. I'd never seen rain like this. Thick streams of water cascaded off the roof in columns. They looked to me like bars on a jail cell. I slowly stuck my hand out to disrupt the flow, momentarily breaking the bars. But I pulled my hand away, and the bars were back. I felt stuck. I felt like a prisoner. Did I really want to be someone who jailed others? Police officers did so many noble things, but was that who I was? I didn't know. I didn't know who I was supposed to be. I was becoming dark in my thoughts. I was road-worn, fatigued. Was I losing my mind? I was extremely hungry and worried about running out of food. Ed and I had fewer conversations. What was there to talk about? I turned to my book of plays. I sank deep into Hedda Gabler, reading by the daylight filtered through the rain clouds. The entire drama unfolds in a single room. But though I was stuck at that rest stop, the play didn't make me feel more claustrophobic. The opposite. It set me free. I forgot about where I was. I forgot time. When I got to the last page, I was straining to make out the words. My only light source was a street lamp 50 feet away. It was night. I was astonished. I hadn't noticed the change from day to dusk to night. How could I have missed that? I was so completely absorbed in the play that the story took me away. As I lay there drifting off, I had a feeling. It cast out any shred of ambivalence about what I should do with my life, how I should be. I knew at that moment, lying inside a sleeping bag in a pup tent under a shelter on the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia, I was going to become an actor. After being pelted by a week of ceaseless rain, my active mind had shut down, and at the risk of sounding overly, who cares? It's true. Somehow, my heart and soul had opened up. I saw my future. I saw it so vividly. It was as if I had a conversation with my older self. At that precise moment, I conjured a credo that would guide me for the rest of my life. I will pursue something that I love, and hopefully become good at it, instead of pursuing something that I'm good at, but don't love. When I awoke the next morning, day 7, the skies were clear. A sign? Maybe. It felt that way. I rode away from that shelter knowing exactly what I was going to do. Lifeguard. Ed and I returned to Daytona Beach broke again. We got day jobs on the pool decks of hotels. Officially, I was a lifeguard, but our first order of business wasn't rescuing flailing swimmers. Instead, I was charged with keeping the pool and deck spotless and selling suntan lotion. This was at the oddly named Alaskan Hotel, a box of whitewashed stucco and thin walls, featuring cheap fixtures and cheaper food, and me, a ginger-haired idiot posing as a lifeguard. I wasn't in a position to save my own life. Mostly I hawked subtropic oils and lotions by the caseload, though it wasn't as desirable as the Hawaiian Tropic brand sold at other hotels. Subtropic paid for the pool cleaning and maintenance at the Alaskan. In return, Subtropic got exclusive rights to sell its products on the premises. After selling oils to pale tourists dreaming of a perfect tan, I'd sell them the aloe vera concoction to soothe their nasty sunburns. I negotiated a deal that paid me 50% of whatever I sold. Only commission, no hourly wage. So I tended to focus on selling rather than swabbing the pool deck. Every 3 days, my supplier would count the remaining inventory of bottles unsold, and I'd owe them their cut in cash. Subtropic got the other 50%. He'd then restock my supply for the next 3 days. Here was Sneaky Pete again, working, planning, conniving a way to increase profits poolside. At the end of each day, I would pick up the half-empty bottles of lotion and oil abandoned on the pool deck, and I'd bring them to the subterranean room where the filtration system was housed. Once a week, under the cover of darkness, I would empty all the lotions into one big bucket and all the oils into another, regardless of the brand or SPF rating. Then I would clean the empty subtropic bottles that I had collected and make them look like new. Next, I'd use a funnel to fill the subtropic bottles with the amalgamated liquids, thus creating my own inventory, which I then sold. I kept 100% of what I made on those doctored products. I thought it was pretty clever. Sneaky, but clever. Rainmaker. I gave the pool my daylight hours, crack of dawn to dusk. At night, it was all theater. My epiphany on the Blue Ridge compelled me to stop by the Daytona Playhouse to see if I could help out backstage. I just wanted to be part of the production. Ray Jensen, the artistic director of the Playhouse and the director of the soon-to-open musical The King and I, asked me if I had ever acted before. I timidly shrugged, yes. I was going to continue with, although not that much. But before I could open my mouth, he said, great. How would you like to be in The King and I? The part was mine. But wait, what part? Ray said, the Kralahome, the king's prime minister and right hand. He handed me a script and said, we rehearse in an hour. Try to memorize your lines by then. I looked at him dumbfounded. He laughed. I'm kidding. You have a week. I learned my lines in no time, and my castmate, Louis Rigo, assisted me with my extensive makeup. He applied purple eyeshadow to my lids and the bronze body makeup everywhere else. It was an attempt to turn an Irish and German kid Siamese. The makeup went a long way toward convincing me that I could pull off the performance. I was intimidated and nervous about doing a full-fledged production, in a musical, no less. But for some reason, I'd been given this opportunity, and I was not going to waste it. After early performances, I would remove the purple eyeshadow, but it left a distinct pink hue on my eyelids. I drew a lot of attention, including some unwanted romantic advances, as I went around town with my eyes painted pink. I consulted Lewis for advice. He told me put a layer of Vaseline on my lids prior to the makeup. That would allow me to wipe it all off after the show without leaving any color behind. Perfect. I did as Lewis instructed. In a very physical performance under the hot stage lights, Near the end of the play, the Vaseline began melting into my eyes. Apparently, I had applied too much. I tried to wipe it away, but the damage was done. My eyes were stinging and burning, and everything on stage was a blur. Though I could make out the shapes of people and objects just enough to fake my way around. I gave a disastrous performance, or that's what I thought. At the end of the play, when the king was dying, the crawler home was bereft, and I knelt down by His Majesty's side to recite a few mournful last words. Vaseline tears streamed down my face, forming a small puddle on stage. As I struggled to concentrate, from the darkness of the audience I could hear sympathetic murmurs. Did I hear people crying? At the curtain call, my applause was much bigger than it had ever been. After the show, audience members and cast congratulated me on a great performance. No one knew that I was using PEV, performance-enhancing Vaseline. Later that night, I thought about what it would be like if I could elicit that kind of reaction in people by really feeling the emotion, truly experiencing the pain of the character, allowing real tears to flow, or relishing real affection, or getting overtaken by real anger, or feeling real anything on stage. I'd gotten a taste of what it was to be an actor, a real actor with an audience. When I gave a performance, I drew from the script and my experience and my instincts and everything I was. I gave something to the audience, and they fed off me. And I fed off them. I could feel a kind of hive mind at work in the darkness of the theater. A symbiosis. A connection. I didn't have any craft, and I didn't have a vocabulary to describe it then, but I felt its power, and I wanted more. After The King and I acted in There's a Girl in My Soup. And then Ray Jensen asked Lewis and me to produce Tennessee Williams' play The Night of the Iguana. We agreed. Let's see what producing is about. About 3 days before we opened, Ray Jensen quit. He had been embroiled in a fight with the board of directors and tempestuously walked out. With nowhere else to turn, the board asked Lewis and me to take over. Lewis was more experienced and thought it best if he called the show and handled the technical aspects, while I stepped in as creative director. I had 3 days to put the finishing touches on the play, which centered on a defrocked priest, Shannon, who'd ended up in subtropical Mexico and was coming to terms with his failures. The play was about self-imprisonment, how we can be trapped by our own decisions, our own inadequacies. I thought about how I'd felt jailed by the rain on the Blue Ridge Parkway. What if we could make it rain on stage? I was imagining a gossamer wall of water, a wall you could see through but couldn't fully penetrate. It was perfect for the story. I talked to the construction guy, and we devised a plan to fashion a system so that rain could hit the roof and then cascade down to form a curtain between the actors and the audience. The water would flow into a trough hidden downstage, which would lead to a basin outdoors. We figured out a way to do it cheaply without inflicting any damage on the theater. We took it to the theater board and described how it could safely be done. But some complacent board members weren't comfortable with such a crazy idea. "We don't need to do that," they said. "We don't need to do anything," I argued. "None of us needs to be here. But we're here to tell a story the best we can for our audience. Otherwise, what's the point?" I fought for it and eventually won. It rained on stage. It wasn't just a visual trick. It supported and amplified the story. Our audiences loved it. They gasped in awe. A year before, I was a police science major. Now I was demanding rain, and getting rain. As the Playhouse's season was ending, my brother heard about parts in the chorus of the Summer Music Theater. I auditioned with a song I knew well from my nights at the Akutiki, Elvis Presley's Return to Sender. Not your typical audition song for musical theater, but it was all I had in my hip pocket, so I gave it a shot. Ed and I both made the cut. In retrospect, I don't think the local talent pool was that deep. And we were offered the summer gig. It paid $75 per week, terrible money, even back in 1978. But we weren't doing it for the money. The lineup was Two Gentlemen of Verona, Pirates of Penzance, and Damn Yankees. I loved Damn Yankees, of course, because it was about baseball. In the cast was a talented but reckless actor, Kevin McTeague, who played the role of Mr. Applegate, a.k.a. the Devil. The role was fun and wicked and powerful. I coveted that part. One day, McTeague disappeared. We had heard he'd split with a girlfriend to parts unknown. I thought maybe I'd throw my hat into the ring. Maybe I could play Mr. Applegate. But I never followed through on my impulse. I was just a kid. I barely made the chorus. I'd be foolish to think I had a shot at the part. I wasn't ready. For the first time, I felt the pang of wanting more than I had, more than I was given, more than I allowed myself to think was possible. Someday I should play that role, I thought. Maybe even on Broadway. Hypnotist. I met Michelle, Mickey, Middleton, at the Daytona Playhouse. She was pretty, kind, talented, a couple years older than me. I don't recall asking her out on a date, really. We were just part of a crew of theater rats who hung out together from the moment I walked into the playhouse. We all spent long nights working out scenes, and we shared pitchers of beer and oysters at the local bar, and we played in backgammon tournaments around Daytona. Backgammon was the craze. We also stared into the blank slate of the future, nursing fantasies about what our lives would be like when we were real actors. We shared our hopes and goals. We were friends, and then more. I looked up one day, and I had a girlfriend. A girlfriend I would often put under. My cousin Freddie had learned hypnosis to try to help his mother cope with breast cancer, and he taught me some basic techniques. Not everyone is susceptible to hypnosis. If you're an open, emotional person, it's more apt to work on you. If you're guarded, not so much. I was hard to hypnotize, despite my effort and desire. I couldn't shut down my racing mind. But Mickey? A few seconds and sweet Mickey was gone. Lights out, Daytona Beach. I became the hypnotizer and she was the hypnotee. We developed a visual cue and a verbal cue. The visual one was that I'd hold out my hand in front of her and collapse my fingers into my palm to make a fist. By the time my fingers were in a fist, she'd be out. The verbal cue was that I'd count from the date of my birthday, the 7th, to hers, the 12th. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. By the time I said 12, she was out. Mickey was so susceptible that I had to be careful not to include either cue in casual conversation, and when I took her under, I made sure she was protected and out of harm's way. Freddie taught me how to install positive suggestions in Mickey's psyche. If she was nervous about an audition, I would hypnotize her beforehand and plant affirmations. If she was worried about a family member's health, I would assuage her fears. We also planted harmless and fun suggestions. Every time you hear Freddie's name, you must touch him. Sure enough, when she came out of hypnosis, each time she heard his name, she'd find some rationale to grasp Freddie's hand or wipe lint off his shoulder, having no idea why. Or, for example, we'd plant, "When you hear the word sandy, you clap." And sure enough, when someone said, "The floor is sandy," Mickey would find some justification to clap her hands. "Guys," she'd clap her hands, "it's time to get going." Skeptics always said, "No, no, it's an act." But believe me, it wasn't an act. It wasn't a gag. I'd see Mickey go under, deep, and it was real, and it was wild. If I remember correctly, there are 7 stages of depth in hypnosis. Freddie and I practice to see how far we can get Mickey to go. Occasionally, I would get nervous. "She's at level 6. I feared we couldn't get her back, but that never came to pass. Hypnosis was a kind of intimacy, I guess, a trust. And Mickey was a good girlfriend. But we were primarily a couple because Mickey wanted us to be a couple. That is not a knock on her, but a comment on who I was at the time. Even though I had gained a nascent sense of what I wanted to do professionally, I was still immature. The Daytona Summer Music Theater season ended in August, and Ed and I resolved to head back to Los Angeles. We'd been on the road for 2 years, and it was time to go home. We had both decided. Law enforcement was not our path. We were both going to be actors. A few weeks before the journey west, I was trying to tell Mickey, "I hope I see you sometime." Vague, distant future talk. But she interrupted. "I want to come with you." She was emphatic. I couldn't think of a good reason to say no. She also wanted to try to make it in show business. Who was I to say Los Angeles was off limits? "Sure," I said. "Come along." Off we went, the three of us. Mickey on the back of my bike. We took 6 weeks and really saw the country on our return trip. We made it as far north as the beautiful, desolate Badlands of South Dakota and marveled at Mount Rushmore before arcing down in a southwesterly direction toward home. Little goblins and ghosts dotted the streets on the day we arrived in Los Angeles. Halloween. Mickey and I settled into a two-bedroom apartment in Van Nuys. My main focus was building my life as an actor. Mickey's focus was marriage, a house, a baby. She had incredibly precise domestic dreams and notions. There was a church choir component. She came from a Southern Baptist family so tight-knit that when we moved west, Mickey's dad, who had been president of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, asked to move his president's office to Embry-Riddle in Prescott, Arizona, to be closer to us. After a couple years together, Mickey wanted to get married. I wasn't self-aware or courageous enough to say, "Whoa." Instead, I said, "You want to get married? Okay, sounds good to me." I don't remember what I was thinking as I watched her walk down the aisle. I know Mickey looked happy. I know I was nervous. But that's about all I can conjure up. I must have been a stranger to myself. I was just a kid, 23 years old, dressed in a very 1970s tuxedo, standing at a makeshift altar at her parents' house in Prescott, Arizona, a little town in Yavapai County, saying, "I do," when what I really felt like saying was, "I don't know." Though I had officiated other people's weddings, I don't think I grasped the depth and the consequence of the commitment I was making. The vows I spoke weren't empty. I cared about her. I even loved her. But in the end, I wasn't ready. Estranged son. The motel my mother and Peter bought in Florida didn't pan out. To no one's surprise, she and Peter didn't pan out either. Shortly after they moved back to California, they split. My mom moved to a mobile home in Desert Hot Springs. Her hobbies included finding early bird specials, flirting with men, and drinking. She switched from wine to anything. Once, I went to visit her in her trailer, and she took 3 trips into the bathroom in a span of an hour. Each time she returned a little more inebriated. I went to the bathroom on a hunch and searched around. I finally lifted the lid off the toilet tank and peered inside. I saw a tall, thin plastic container filled halfway with a clear liquid. I picked it up and unscrewed the top and smelled it. Vodka. That's the kind of alcoholic she had become. My poor sister, Amy. With good reason, she had run away from my mom when they were living in Florida. After dropping out of high school at 16, she was waiting tables living in North Hollywood with our family friend Julia, the one who eventually married my brother to stay in the country. Amy got her GED, but it would take her several years to decide she wanted to go back to school and become a nurse. Ed and I saw our mom sporadically, and we checked in on Amy and Julia in their little 2-bedroom apartment as often as we could. But we were laser-like in our focus. We wanted to be actors. Ed changed his name, again, and enrolled at UCLA as a theater major as Kyle Cranston. I took the impatient route. I wanted to get to work right away. Though our paths were different, our purpose was the same, and that spurred us to track down our dad. We hadn't seen him in a decade, but my paternal grandmother, Alice, was still alive, so he wasn't hard to find. I guess we could have tried earlier, but I think we'd assumed he didn't have any interest. He left, after all. But now we had a subject. Men have to have a subject, a reason. If a guy said to me, "Let's have lunch together," I'd say, "What's up?"